Welcome to Connecting the Community podcast. I am your host, Marge Andre. I will be connecting you to people, organizations, and events that create community. I am creating this podcast in Richmond Hill, an eclectic and very culturally diverse community with lots of trees and streams and interesting people, just up the hill from Toronto. I will be discussing the issues of well-being and mental health frequently on this CTC podcast. There will be a day a week when I'm going to talk about how are you feeling? For this podcast, I have two individuals, Kim Fluxgold and Kathleen McNacki, join me. They are both effective advocates for mental health issues. A focus for this podcast is the role of family and community for those with mental health issues. Kim, welcome, and please tell us a little bit about yourself and your mental health story.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast. This has kind of become like a passion and a purpose for me over the last many years. And I'm just very honored to be here today to share a piece of my journey and how it has led me to become a mental health advocate, a blogger, and the author of my children's book as well. And I just hope that others listening can, you know, gain something from my story as well. So I'll just go back to April of 2014. It was a Friday afternoon. I walked out of work, shaken and scared. And I'd been working at a job for several months for a man, who I can't even really call a man, who was doing some very illegal and unethical stuff behind the scenes. And I got into my car that day feeling completely broken and defeated after an incident that had happened. And the last thing I remember kind of doing after that was texting my husband and telling him I wanted to die before shutting off my phone and disappearing for hours and hours. I lost my will to live that day, and I felt like hopeless and worthless, and I felt like a failure in every sense of the word, and I especially felt like a burden to everyone who loved me. And it took me several years until I kind of found the right therapist who kind of helped me understand that my pain and suffering had stemmed way back further than just that day in 2014. Way back, I'd say, to my formative years and the paths in life I regret not taking, which kind of built up over time and finally broke me that day. It then led to a diagnosis of major and chronic depression and severe anxiety disorder. And eventually, after several failed attempts at medications and treatments, which I'm still dealing with today, an added diagnosis of treatment-resistant depression was also added to that. My journey, I'd say, is very long and very tiresome, with many hospital admissions and emergency room visits. And it was during my very first hospital admission back in the fall of 2014, where I'd spent over three months, and I fell in love with journaling during that time, which I'd forgotten how much I loved doing, writing and things like that as a child and a teen. And eventually, when I was ready, I began sharing my story on social media and eventually turned it into a blog. And I was receiving such an overwhelming amount of support from people everywhere. People thought I was so brave and were so appreciative for me being so open and honest that I continued to share more and more. And my voice, which I never take for granted, has helped so many people to understand the many depths of living with a mental illness and that it's not a weakness. And it's helped reduce the stigma as well and helped many people know that it's like okay to not be okay. And it's, you know, given others the strength to start conversations and find the courage to ask for help. But most importantly, it's helped so many people feel less alone. And several years ago, I took my love of writing and my passion for helping others one step further. And I self-published one of my pieces I'd written and turned it into a book for children. Okay. And it's since become a guide for parents and teachers and caregivers to help children cope with and understand their feelings when someone they love is suffering with depression. And it's a book that is a labor of love, but it's also a story that affects like millions of families around the world every day.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to open up dialogues, I believe, you know, as young as preschool age on these matters and help people learn and understand our actions and behaviors early on and acceptance, etc.
Very good. Kim, thank you so much for sharing. I've seen your book. It's amazing. And I will put a link to the book and your blog in the podcast notes. So again, thank you, Kim.
Thank you.
Kathleen, can you introduce yourself and tell us your mental health story?
Well, thank you very much, Marge, for this opportunity. And Kim, it's a delight meeting you and hearing your story. My story is a little different because it is as the mother of an adult child with a psychotic illness. So the tone is different because it's of a family member and not a person with the illness. I'm a Kathleen McMackie, and I'm a member of the Canadian Alliance of Family Groups supporting those with a psychotic illness. This is a new group that has been founded to address the profound need to look at what can be the most helpful treatments for those with psychotic illness. This is not happening presently in our country because we just need to look at the large number of homeless people who have untreated psychotic illness. Psychotic illness is where the person is experiencing delusions, hallucinations, disorganized thinking, lack possibly of motivation, possibly also the symptom of anosognosia where they're not even aware that they have an illness. I'm also a co-founder and past president of Home in the Hills Supportive Housing, which is a family-driven initiative that has a small housing program where my son is a tenant. And also, I'm the founder of the Robert Belthier Lecture Series, which serves to educate people about serious mental illness and hopefully address stigma. Currently, I'm on the implementation committee of the Affordable Housing Strategy of Richmond Hill, and I'm involved in a supportive housing initiative that involves a number of community agencies, but we're very much at the beginning stage, so I don't really want to talk about it, but currently that's what I'm involved in.
Okay.
My mental health journey began when my son started experiencing some of the symptoms that he didn't know what was happening and I didn't know what was happening. And so I would take him to psychiatrists, psychologists, child psychiatrists, pediatricians. Sometimes he was so full of anxiety that he couldn't even say anything when we would visit these mental health professionals. That happened on three occasions. At the same time, I was also a mental health case manager. So I was a service provider in the formal mental health system. So I noticed the difference in perspectives as a service provider compared to the perspective of a mother of an adult child with psychotic illness. And there is a huge gap in perspective. What I noticed was, first of all, when my son had his first psychotic break, I took him to a major hospital downtown, a teaching hospital, and I informed the nurse in emergency of what I believed was a psychotic break. I mean, I was a professional in the field, so I felt I did have an understanding of what was happening. So I expected her to take notes and inform the psychiatrist about my son's situation. This didn't appear to have happened because my son ended up in general psychiatry, where I ended up, confronting the psychiatrist who would not agree that he was psychotic. So, you know, this was my beginning experience as a mother of an adult child with a psychotic illness. I also noticed that there was a lack of mental health literacy among mental health professionals. Sometimes my son's behavior was misjudged as bad behavior when actually it was a symptom of his illness. I noticed that there's a lack of accountability. I have used every entity of accountability in the mental health system. And, you know, they really are not working. We need to have accountability to improve our current services. I also noticed that mental health legislation is not realistic because it does not address the symptom, vanosognosia, where the person doesn't even know that they're ill, so therefore cannot agree to treatment if they don't believe that they're ill. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and also, the profound need for supportive housing, and that's how I got together with other parents to develop supportive housing. Really, so that's good. My journey.
Okay. Thank you, Kathleen and Kim. You have amazing stories. What we want to talk about a bit today is the importance of family and the broader community. Kim, I read your blogs, your Facebook postings. I know that your family is really important. Can you speak about that?
Well, I am just going to start. I will say that family doesn't have to be defined by blood in many cases. It really means like feeling a sense of belonging, a willingness to embrace our differences, being able to kind of celebrate the wins and or wipe away the tears as well, and always having the ability to kind of value one another no matter what. It's no secret, as you said, to those who do know me, that my, you know, three kids who are now 24, 23, and 20, and my husband are everything to me. And I'm especially blessed to have a husband who showers me with tremendous amount of support. But nonetheless, my illness has also had a tremendous impact on our family's cohesiveness. I mean, how could it not impact our lives? Just like it would if our family was dealing with any other kind of life-threatening illness or disease. Basically, when one or more parts of your family unit does become broken, there is no doubt in my mind that it will have an effect on the rest of it. But of course, with depression also comes the added guilt that even the smallest impact of my illness may have had on them, and that I blame it myself and feel like it's all my fault. And, you know, during the last 8+ years that I've been going through this journey, there's been a great deal of confusing, stressful, and sometimes very unsettling emotions surrounding our family's cohesiveness. And the buildup over time is sometimes difficult to navigate alone, which is why we continue to keep a very open dialogue with our kids. As I said, they're not kids anymore, though, but they still, you know, need that open dialogue. And that's, you know, the cohesiveness of a family. Still, like, keeping the lines of communication open is just so imperative. And knowing that you do have a family who loves you and supports you is what, you know, kind of keeps me going at my lowest points. And because of my advocacy and my blogging, I'm just as blessed to have a village of added support surrounding me always.
Very good. Thank you, Kim, for that sharing. And family's important. Your mom, and I think moms are always feel guilty. And I think I can see in your case, yeah. So Kathleen, you also share that motherly guilt that, it's all my fault, I haven't done enough.
Yeah, I know. You know, it's interesting. My son emailed me recently and he said, "You are my hero." And I just, it made me tear up because, you know, we families, we go through so much. But anyway, sorry.
No.
The parents of an adult child with a psychotic illness provide a home for their loved one. They financially support their loved one. They cook for their loved one. They drive their loved one to appointments and they pick up pharmacy at the pharmacist, right? We also oversee the possibility of a relapse, you know, if there's symptoms of a relapse or if there's side effects of medication. That's the role we play with our family member who has an illness. But if our family member goes into the hospital, all of a sudden we're excluded from the treatment team. And doctors and nurses don't necessarily ask the patient if they want the family involved. So often, you know, we're not told about the treatment, how the treatment is working or whether it's not working, or even when the person is discharged. Clinicians have been known not to ask the patient if they want their family involved. And they've also been known not to explain to the patient the importance that the family involvement would mean, you know, to inform the family of what is going on and how the family can be helpful. So that's a big gap in the system. Our listeners will actually be quite shocked to hear how Canadian Health Services and their political overseers to families were excluded from the discussions within the hospital, and were also excluded from providing input into the design of services, which is really important. My son now he's done so well. He now has a permanent part-time job because he lives in supportive housing that was developed by families. And he has received rehabilitative services within supportive housing that's increased his self-worth. And now he has a permanent part-time job. He's even got a raise just recently. This was not happening in the mainstream system, where the services that he got were not successful. And they're also, I experienced quite a bit of pain with them. So we need to hear that. The decision makers need to hear that. Families need to input into the development of services. And also, when our family member is in the hospital, we need to be part of the treatment team. At a systems level, families are often not included in committees. And if we are, it's at a token level. Myself and another mom sat on one council for 3 years, and we felt we were not heard. They seem to tokenize us, and they prefer the voices of those with lived experience. So this is not this was not a productive use of our time. So families need to be more meaningfully engaged in the system.
Very good. Yeah. You have some really good points, Kathleen. I think really highlighting things that many of us don't think about. Kim, do you want to comment some more about the importance of family support in when there are serious issues?
Yeah, I know two things for me. When I was in hospital, at one point, the psychiatrist who was dealing with me, brought my kids in for like a family meeting and, to discuss what was, going on and to be honest with them and et cetera. And I felt that was, very important to, again, my book focuses on, the importance of being open and honest so that kids feel safe and not to blame for a parent's illness and things like that. So, I feel that those connections, and this was back in 2014, so they were a lot younger then, and I felt that was really an important step. And at one point, several years ago, my own therapist actually came to my home and sat with my family together, and as well doing the same sort of thing and asking the kids what they need from me and what I need from them, and, you know, setting boundaries and self-care around what my needs are and what their needs are. And just the open communication is just imperative.
Very good. Kim, it's good to hear a positive aspect of that. There are very caring, receptive healthcare, mental health care workers. You know, we are coming out of the pandemic with cries, with pleas to fix a very broken healthcare system. Instead, it's in a crisis situation. Lots need to be done, but you know, what are the top things that you see need to be addressed, again, particularly in regards to mental health? Kim, do you want to start by answering that?
There's just so much. And over the course, you know, of the last 8+ years, as you mentioned, like there are very kind and caring individuals out there who want to help, but I've also, you know, been on the other side of so much brokenness in the system, and had so many, you know, horrific and experiences pertaining to our broken healthcare system, which have kind of left me many, many times feeling just as broken. And if I can just emphasize here one thing that is so important to be able to kind of move forward is self-advocacy, which is just the number one most important way that we can honestly help fix the system that we're living in right now and fix the problem. And given coming out of the pandemic, the amount of people suffering now is just crazy. And, you know, essentially self-advocacy involves learning how to, you know, speak up for yourself and knowing your self-worth and communicating it, asking questions and problem solving. And sometimes, unfortunately, because of our healthcare system, we have to just stand up and do it ourselves and not kind of take no for an answer. You know, I've been yearning for years to find a treatment to, you know, basically treat my treatment-resistant depression, and have faced just one obstacle after another. Even being turned away once when I was in crisis, I was in an emergency room, and the ER doctor found out for me that I was not taking antidepressants anymore, and he, without even consulting with the crisis team, which he should be, he just felt like I guess I felt unworthy of a bed because of him, and that the only method of treatment, you know, going on to the psychiatric ward, you know, and keeping somebody safe was not a priority when I was in a suicidal, you know, state. And he just felt like, well, the only way they're, you know, going to help you is if you take medication, and that is not my purpose anymore at all. And I've had to, you know, I just also wanted to add how important like education is for all doctors, because especially dealing with that one, you know, one incident, you know, not just those in mental health, but because so many more and more like GPs are being forced to look after patients, especially pertaining to like medication distribution and stuff. And it's just absurd because they're not properly trained. And my doctor from day one was like, I am not trained in, you know, medications and things like that. But the system is just so bombarded and there's not enough psychiatrists to go around. I remember a few years back, my other psychiatrist I had, he moved to Alberta, and before he left, he basically said that there was 1,000 or something or other psychiatrists in all of Ontario, and, you know, and he was now going to make it 999, you know, so it was, there's just not enough to help us. And it's, you know, and the wait times to see a psychiatrist is just absurd and beyond scary. And it's killing people. And of course, we need to fix the problem as well with more funding available from the government in order for everyone, no matter what your gender, socioeconomic background or status is, we all deserve affordable and accessible mental health treatments and care. And it's just something needs to be done, especially for our youth right now. As I said, like, the pandemic has made our youth suffering go up 100 times with addiction and eating disorders, depression, anxiety. It's just too much, and there's not enough being done. And, you know, I myself have had to ask very difficultly the community to help me for certain treatments that are not covered by our OHIP system in order to try and save my life. It's not an easy thing to do. And these are just many of the reasons so many people still choose to not get help, and sending more, many into self-harm and taking their own lives, which I strongly believe that in order to fix our broken healthcare system, we just need to first combat the unwarranted stigma around mental illness as well. And education is key. And we just need to be talking about mental illness like we do that of cancer and diabetes.
Yeah, Kim, you've said some important things about education of healthcare workers, physicians, self-advocacy, need for more staff, more qualified people. And again, this reducing of stigma. Kathleen, I have a sense that you can also speak to this issue of what needs to be done for a broken healthcare system.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that the COVID situation was, people probably didn't realize this because families are hidden, you know, from the mainstream general public. But we families really experienced a lot of stress during the COVID situation because our loved ones couldn't get out. The services were not available. They were at loose ends. They, you know, there was things like hygiene and wearing of masks, which were difficult for our loved ones. You know, these procedures were difficult for our loved ones to follow. So as a caregiver, it gave me a lot of stress. In fact, I became under a doctor's care because I was under a lot of stress. People don't realize that. That's invisible. But what I really want to focus on is the need to listen to families of the most severest mentally ill. Currently, our services are crisis-focused. We do not want crisis-focused services. I've had enough police cars on my driveway. I've had enough fire engines. I've had my son taken off to hospital in a police car. That is not acceptable. We don't want any more of that. That is very traumatic for we families and for our loved ones. What we would like to see is a focus on rehabilitative supports, like supportive housing, like vocational training, like recreation therapy, like effective case management. That's what we need. We don't need crisis-focused supports with all the police cars and the ambulances. It's more expensive. It's very intrusive. It's traumatic. We can't forget these experiences. So please listen to the families of the most seriously mentally ill. We want rehabilitative supports, not crisis-focused supports. And I really wish that they would start listening to us, because they listen to people that are less, they're less compromised by their illness, they're more articulate, and they listen to these people, but they don't listen to us, who are representing people who often cannot speak for themselves. And I want that message loud and clear. I want the politicians to listen, because I've been engaging with politicians recently, because I'm so fed up. They need to really find out what psychotic illness is all about and listen to the people that are affected. I know, Marge, and you know, know that there's going to be another horrible situation that's going to happen in our community. We've mm-hmm. had a number of these already. This results in terrible outcomes for the loved one or for the family member. Mm-hmm. We know these situations are inevitable. So I'm asking any politician that is listening right now, please listen to families. You know, none of this, crisis focused support. Right now, as you know, they're building a crisis hub in Newmarket. We don't want that. Our loved ones will not get in a car and go to a crisis center because many of them have anosognosia and they don't believe that they're ill. So families are suffering chronic crisis at home and it's not recognized. We need our politicians to listen.
Yep. Thank you for that, saying that so strongly, Kathleen. I will make sure that our local politicians, I will send this podcast to them directly. So thank you for that. We have a lot of work to do. I think part of the work is really understanding the complexity, the variances of mental health. And we as a community have a lot to do. So we're going to end this podcast with a question that I'm going to be asking everyone. Kathleen, what is one thing you like about this community?
I love the fact that this community has such strong community engagement. I am so proud to live in Richmond Hill. I have seen a turnaround because of effective organizations like Connecting the Community, like the Council Accountability Group, like a Better Richmond Hill, like Richmond Hill Good Neighbors. These people, I admire them so much because we have an improvement in council right now, and hopefully we're having an election on October 24th. Hopefully there will be some good people on council. So I'm very proud to be a member of Richmond Hill, and I really am very proud of the community engagement.
Woo! Now, very good to hear that, Kathleen. I like that. Kim, what's one thing you like about the community?
I mean, I agree completely with that. And, you know, through everything that I do within my community, I really have to say that it's the people, you know, so many people and the kindness that surrounds it. I feel often like, no matter what, I feel in my community a sense of belonging and it brings comfort and connection and respect. And there's a lot of appreciation, for the most part, within our community. So I just have to, it's the people, really.
It's the people. Okay. I very much like that answer, Kim. So Kim, Kathleen, thank you so much for joining me for this podcast. Both of you have put in such worthwhile information. So hope to see you around town soon. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Please tune in next week as we continue to explore the community. Consider emailing me at marj@marjandre.com. I welcome suggestions for podcast guests. Stay well, stay connected.